What's my subscription to the New York Times have me doing this week? Preparing a strawberry pretzel pie. Solving spelling bee with no hints. Planning a trip to one of the 52 best places to go. Getting to the bottom of the big pants trend.
Whoa.
And I'm finally replacing my vacuum with a recommendation I can trust. What will your subscription to the Times have you do? Why not find out? With our best offer, go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, it was barely noticed when Lyndon Johnson created it 50 years ago. Now it's so big and so popular that a proposal to roll it back could sink the Republican plan to replace the Affordable Care Act. The rise of Medicaid. It's Wednesday, July 5th.
Mr. Speaker, I rise today to express my deep misgivings about the recent health care proposals put forth by the Senate.
But I do have concerns, particularly in the area of Medicaid.
And I have concerns about the way the Medicaid issue is being handled, particularly in the expansion states I've talked
about. We want to make certain that Medicaid is a program that can survive. The program is actually failing many, many patients, and we need to fix that, and so we need to make that make it so that those individuals can transition.
Kate Zernke, I have a very simple, but I fear actually a very complicated question for you. What is Medicaid?
That is a complex question, isn't it? So Medicaid is the federal government and states program to offer health insurance or help pay the medical bills of the poor. It now covers about 1 in 5 Americans, about 78 million
people. That's a lot of
people. So it's a lot of people, yeah. Covers half the births in this country. It covers, let's see, 2/3 of nursing home residents are on Medicaid. It is not just the poor anymore. It's the disabled. It's elderly people who are in nursing homes who have maybe exhausted their savings. So the Medicaid population now is really quite broad.
So let's roll this back just a little bit. Where did Medicaid come from originally? What is its history?
So starting in about the 1940s in this country, employers started to offer people health insurance.
No one wants to meet with an accident, but each year many employees are the victims of avoidable accidents.
But then the question became, what are we going to do about people who can't work? So the elderly and the poor.
Our older people are likely to be hospitalized 3 times as often as younger people.
And it's interesting when you look at stories about Lyndon Johnson signing this bill that created Medicare and Medicaid in 1965, you know, the stories barely mention Medicaid.
But their income is less than half that of people under 65.
The elderly was the biggest question, and that was the biggest fight. And the fight was over the program that became Medicare, which is, of course, the government health insurance program for elderly people.
The end result is what? They then turn to public welfare. Now, this is not the American way.
Medicaid, oddly enough, was sort of this almost an afterthought thrown in, and nobody envisioned that it would become this huge program. You know, considering the political debate over it now, you never would have guessed that in 1965.
So in 1965, at its birth, exactly who did Medicaid cover?
It really was just the poor.
The passage of Medicare is a dream come true.
How did Medicaid go from being this footnote, kind of barely mentioned thing in 1965, as you just described it, to being something that so many Americans, so many millions of Americans now rely on for healthcare?
Yeah, 78 million. So, of course, initially it was expanded under President Lyndon Johnson, a Democrat. And in the 70s, the American Medical Association was very much against the expansion of Medicare. They called it socialized medicine. And one of their biggest advocates for their position.
My name is Ronald Reagan.
Was Ronald Reagan, who, of course, was an actor at the time. And Ronald Reagan recorded this record calling Medicare socialized medicine.
One of the traditional methods of imposing statism or socialism on a people has been by way of medicine. Now, the American people, if you put it to them about socialized medicine and gave them a chance to choose, would unhesitatingly vote against it.
Well, lo and behold, years later, some of the biggest expansions of Medicaid began in the Reagan years, and it was because of compromises worked out between Democrats and Republicans. But one of the compromises was with Henry Hyde. Henry Hyde is most known for the Hyde Amendment, which prevents federal funds from being spent on abortion. Mm-hmm. So Henry Hyde doesn't want to cover abortion with federal money. So the Democrats say to him, okay, if we're not going to cover abortion with this, we need to take care of pregnant women and their children. So that's one big expansion.
Since we first came to Washington, I've been chairing the president's task force on health care.
Under Clinton, after the Clinton failure of Bill Clinton's health care plan, which is, of course, sometimes called Hillary Care, there was agreement between Democrats and Republicans that they didn't want to pass this enormous, you know, what Republicans would have called socialized medicine, Hillary Care, Clinton Care. But they wanted, there was agreement that we wanted to insure children. Mm-hmm. So Clinton had the Children's Health Insurance Program, which has now become this hugely popular program. So that was a Bill Clinton initiative.
And another Medicaid expansion.
Another Medicaid expansion. And, of course, the CHIP program really sort of paves the way for the largest Medicaid expansion of them all, which is, of course.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you, everybody.
Obamacare, or the Affordable Care Act, which was passed in 2010.
Today, after almost a century of trying, today, after over a year of debate, today, after all the votes have been tallied, health insurance reform becomes law in the United States of America.
So exactly how does the Affordable Care Act expand and change Medicaid?
Well, initially, Medicaid was envisioned as a welfare program, right? And Democrats for years have been trying to separate it from welfare mm-hmm. and say, Democrats were saying, hey, let's make this our way to provide universal health insurance, mm-hmm. right? So that's kind of what Obamacare did, was decouple Medicaid from welfare, because it was saying to people who weren't maybe welfare level poor, but still pretty poor, mm-hmm. we're going to help you get health insurance. Now, Obamacare, we have to be careful about one thing, which is that there's Medicaid, there's the expansion of Medicaid under Obamacare, but there's also the health insurance exchanges, right? That was not a Medicaid expansion. So the Obamacare does two things in terms of expanding health insurance. It expands Medicaid to help people at slightly above the mm-hmm. poverty level, but it also creates these exchanges where people who are not at poverty and, in fact, quite well above it can also go in and buy health insurance.
And what was the opposition to the Affordable Care Act's expansion of Medicaid? Because there, as I recall, there was a lot of opposition to it.
Absolutely. I mean, this was, you know, if you think about it, this was the genesis of the Tea Party in the summer of 2009.
How do you want members of Congress to vote on this bill?
No!
But the opposition was really what Republican opposition has been all along, which is that these are handouts, right? These people are able-bodied. They can go out and get a job if they really needed health insurance. Why are we subsidizing these people?
Kill the bill! Kill the bill! Kill the bill!
You know, that opposition, in as much as it fueled the Tea Party and as much as it sort of stoked populism in this country, which is, and populism in this country has always been, you know, feeling like someone above you is like getting something that you don't have and someone below you is getting something that they don't deserve. And so a lot of, you know, maybe middle class or working people look at the Medicaid expansion and think, well, wait a minute, I had to earn this. Or my mother, who paid down her little bitty savings to get into that nursing home on Medicaid, she had to pay down her savings. Why is this person just walking on? And there is a lot, you know, if you've listened to people, there's a lot of these people, you know, these people who have come and gotten Medicaid.
And how many people have started to receive their health care through Medicaid since the Affordable Care Act expanded it?
11 million people.
That's a pretty big number.
Yeah.
Just since 2010.
Yep. I think it's always easier to say no to something, right? So the Tea Party was saying, no, don't do this. Now that it's in place, Medicaid's actually become kind of popular. Pollsters will tell you it's actually always been popular, but I think the Medicaid expansion has made it even more popular.
So what would the GOP healthcare plan, which started in the House, passed, and is now complicatedly making its way through the Senate, what would that do to the Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act that has brought insurance to 11 million new people?
In general, the bills would shrink the amount of money that the federal government is giving to the states to pay for Medicaid. So Affordable Care Act Medicaid expansion, the federal government started out paying 100% of
wow.
states' costs. Then it went down to 95. Now it's at 90. It's supposed to go down, I think, to 85 or 80. But instead of having those percentages and saying to states, however many people come and sign up for Medicaid, we're always going to pay this share of your costs, it's saying we're going to put a per capita cap on this Medicaid funding.
But just to be clear, under the current Affordable Care Act Medicaid expansion, it sounds like the federal government is on the hook for potentially huge amounts of money to pay the states to make sure that their Medicaid population is cared for.
Yeah.
Under the Republican Senate plan, there will be some form of a cap. It'll say, that's it.
Yeah.
Okay.
This is, no question, a huge outlay of federal money, right? Medicare is about $581 billion last year. Medicaid is $553 billion. Of that, the federal government's paying about $350 billion. I mean, it's just an enormous amount of money. So there's no question. I mean, you know, when people come in, every time people have talked about deficit reduction, right, we've talked about, you know, we've had like decades of people saying, oh, we're going to cut waste. We're going to cut bureaucracy. We're going to cut this. Really, unless you cut entitlements, you're not going to cut the federal deficit.
So why is this such a partisan issue? If everyone agrees that Medicaid is really expensive and maybe even too expensive.
It's interesting. In some ways, I think it's become less a partisan issue. It has become a more polarized issue, like everything in this country in the last, you know, 10 years. But I actually think what you're seeing now is a bunch of Republican governors standing up and saying, don't cut my Medicaid expansion.
In my own state, we have a big concern over the expanded Medicaid population. Mm.
You're seeing Rob Portman and Shelley Capito saying, don't cut Medicaid expansion. It's paying for my opioid treatment in my state, which has a huge opioid epidemic.
Ohio, right.
You know, the addiction, heroin, prescription drugs, now fentanyl.
So I actually think that it is enjoys more bipartisan support. It's just a little more difficult for Republicans just because they are the party of small government. They don't like to think that this is the way we provide health care.
I'm very concerned about the Medicaid portion and what it would do to a state like mine. We have the largest per capita population that's in the Medicaid program. It is a wonderful safety net for so many of our West Virginians.
The bills are not that popular among Republicans, and I think a lot of that is because of the Medicaid expansion, and people are so, like, people have gotten used to Medicaid. It's very hard to take an entitlement away.
How do we explain a state like Kentucky, where a very large expansion of Medicaid occurred since the Affordable Care Act was passed? There's a large percentage of poverty, and there's a massive problem with opioids. And yet, the man who created this Senate Republican health care bill that would roll back the expansion of Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act is Senator Mitch McConnell. He represents Kentucky.
And I would actually argue more crucially is the other senator from that state is Rand Paul, another Republican who's a libertarian Republican, possibly the biggest beneficiary of the Tea Party wave, right? So Rand Paul is from the libertarian strain. Rand Paul does not believe we should be giving these government handouts to people. So in some ways, that part of the Republican Party allowed Mitch McConnell's rise. And so Mitch McConnell knows he's beholden to that point of view. And so Mitch McConnell is also, you know, he's a deal maker, right? And he's someone who moves legislation through. So he's been saying for 7 or 8 years, we're gonna take this away. We're gonna, you know, rip this root and branch. So now he's gotta do that.
The one thing I would say is that I think everybody around the table is interested in getting to yes, interested in getting an outcome, because we know the status quo is simply unacceptable, unsustainable, and no action is just not an option.
In part two of this story, how the Medicaid debate is playing out in the home states of Senator Mitch McConnell and Rand Paul. We'll be right back.
My name is Jasmine Ulloa, and I'm a national politics reporter for The New York Times. I grew up in Texas, on the border with Mexico, and I've been reporting in the region since I was in high school. Now I travel the country looking for stories and voices that really capture what immigration and the nation's demographic changes mean for people. What I keep encountering is that voters don't fall into neat ideological boxes on this very volatile issue. There's a lot of gray. And that's where I feel the most interesting stories are. I'm trying to bring that complexity and nuance to our audience, especially in such a critical election year. And that's really what all of my colleagues on the politics team and every journalist at the New York Times is aiming to do. Our mission is to help you understand the world, no matter how complicated it might be. If you want to support this mission, consider subscribing to the New York Times. You can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
He
here is what else you need to know today. North Korea successfully conducted its first test of an intercontinental ballistic missile on Tuesday, a major milestone in its efforts to build nuclear weapons capable of hitting the United States. The U.S. military says the missile was in the air for 37 minutes, which demonstrates a significant advancement in North Korea's missile capabilities, years sooner than expected, so that it may now be possible for a missile to travel up to 4,000 miles and hit the state of Alaska.
I think I've proven over the last 8 years that I don't really care about political optics.
And
I care about right and wrong.
The state of New Jersey finally has a budget deal after a dramatic weekend standoff involving closed state parks, angry residents, and a photograph of Governor Chris Christie lounging on a beach that he had just ordered be closed to the public.
And if I have a choice to make, I think I've proven over the last 8 years that I have a choice to make between my family and political optics, that I'm going to pick my family. Now, that's our residence. And we have a right to be there whenever we want to be there.
Christie, whose popularity in New Jersey has plunged since he ran for president, had ordered the beaches closed as a negotiating tactic in his budget talks with the state legislature. But an enterprising photographer for a local newspaper, acting on a hunch, flew past the governor's official residence on Sunday and caught Christie and his family on one of those beaches.
Now, if they had flown that plane over that beach, and I was sitting next to a 25-year-old blonde in that beach chair next to me, that's a story. I wasn't sitting next to a 25-year-old blonde. I was sitting next to my wife of 31 years. If that's a scandal, that's a scandal I'm guilty of every day of my life.
That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.